Hello, you're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. Today, the story of one of the world's tiniest nations.
Nauru has expelled its only magistrate and cancelled the visa of the Chief Justice.
It's been a dramatic few days in the Nauruan justice system. The resident magistrate, Australian Peter Law, was expelled from the tiny Pacific nation yesterday. The Chief Justice, another Australian, Geoffrey Eames, issued an injunction against the deportation, but that was ignored and his visa was then cancelled by the President, Baron Wanga.
In January, Nauru expelled its only magistrate and cancelled the visa of its Chief Justice. We'll hear more about those events a bit later, but begin with the story of Nauru itself, an island that's been in the news on and off ever since it became part of the Howard government's Pacific Solution in 2001. The modern history of Nauru, a tiny speck in the South Pacific, begins at the turn of the 20th century with the discovery of phosphate.
Well, actually, as a kid growing up in New Zealand, I was on farmland and we used to drop large quantities of what we used to call superphosphate, and curiosity took you to the next stage and you realised eventually that what we saw being dumped across the sheep farm of Hawke's Bay was in fact the topsoil of a country called Nauru and a neighbouring island of Barnaba.
Michael Field, a reporter with Fairfax Media, has covered the South Pacific for most of the past 35 years.
Essentially what happened was a chap called Albert Ellis in 1899 went off on a bit of an exploration around the Pacific, came back with some rocks, one of which says legend, and it may be true, he ended up using as a doorstop to his Auckland office until he had it tested and discovered that it was highly phosphate rich and was little short of the mother lode. Phosphate's always been incredibly important to pastoral agriculture in both Australia and New Zealand. One of the issues, for example, and you'll hear it said, is that phosphate is bird manure. Essentially, it's not. When you do proper study in Nauru of the soils, you'll find there's a lot more fish bone and fish in the phosphate than there is bird shit, essentially. Phosphate is a fertilizer, and what is important is that it stimulates the strike rate of seedlings, in this particular case in New Zealand, and I think in Australia, pastoral seedlings. When you're trying to grow grass, you lay across the superphosphate, and you get better root development and better flowering and faster plant growth. And the important thing in New Zealand, for example, was that it's quite hard to grow the quality grass you need for the sheep and beef trade. And this was also happening worldwide. Everybody wanted phosphate. And, of course, phosphate is also part of the explosives industry, and the world was arming up incredibly 100 years ago.
Professor John Connell is head of the School of Geosciences at the University of Sydney. He says that phosphate mining left Nauru with a bleak, blasted landscape.
It was very distinctive because the phosphate develops within coral pinnacles. So you have to scoop the phosphate out from within the pinnacles themselves. So those scooped areas descend about 3 metres, and on either side of those, there's these coral pinnacles. So it produces an extraordinary landscape, which is visually quite dramatic and is totally useless for anything else.
Before the phosphate mining began, what did the island look like?
Well, the island is 21 square kilometres, which is quite small, about the size of an average university campus like Sydney or Melbourne. So it's a tiny island. Almost all of it was just rock and scrubby vegetation, except for a significant coastal strip, and that's where everybody lived. It was the interior that eventually became valuable for phosphate.
At the time phosphate was discovered on Nauru, the island was a German protectorate. In 1914, after the outbreak of World War I, Nauru was captured by Australian troops. When the war ended, Nauru was given in trust to Britain, Australia and New Zealand. These three governments created the British Phosphate Commission, which took over the rights to phosphate mining. During the Second World War, the Japanese occupied Nauru, and its inhabitants suffered horribly. Some 1,200 Nauruans, two-thirds of the population, were deported to Micronesia to work as forced labour. 500 died from starvation or bombing. After the war, Nauru was made a UN Trust Territory under Australian administration.
The British Phosphate Commission became the Nauru Phosphate Commission. The ownership remained the same. There was no question of New Zealand or Australia losing control of the phosphate because phosphate was even more important than ever. What happened and what's exposed by the Sri Lankan jurist Christopher Weeramantry, who was hired by Nauru after it became independent, he looked through the accounts under Australian and New Zealand rule and found an extraordinary array of double bookkeeping and lying. We would send one set of accounts to the United Nations and keep a secret set of accounts, which showed an extraordinary degree of robbery was going on. And it was covered up in both Australia and New Zealand. And as quite a young reporter in Wellington years ago, I can remember applying to the government of Robert Muldoon to see the accounts, the annual accounts of the Nauru Phosphate Commission, and being told I was not allowed to see them, that it was a state secret.
The flags of Australia, Britain and New Zealand no longer fly over the island of Nauru. These trustees for the United Nations have handed over to the people of the island. Independence has come after 80 years of foreign rule.
Mr. Chairman, how do you feel about your independence?
Well, we feel very happy. We feel excited. There is also a feeling of sadness because of the fact that by having independence, we are seeing the last of our Australian friends as administrators.
Nauru became the world's smallest independent republic in 1968. Tess Newton-Cain is principal consultant at Dev Pacific, a research consultancy business focused on Pacific development and policy. She says that among the challenges facing the new nation was that it had to pay to get its remaining phosphate deposits back.
Well, I think the main issue that coloured the independence was basically the trusteeship nations negotiated quite assertively with Nauru that the new country should take on a large debt in order to buy out interests in the phosphate mining. So that was the biggest bit of baggage that they had to carry, was that in order to take ownership of those resources, the country was basically in debt from day one to the pre-existing countries and corporate interests that had owned and managed the mining. So obviously that was part of it. Then there was all the issues around setting up a new country and taking on its own administration and government. And I guess the thing is there that Nauru has had a very turbulent political history post-independence. I think since 1968, only two governments have survived a full three-year term. So we've seen lots of political instability. There's no real sense of political parties in Nauru. You know, Nauru was always going to face a very difficult path in terms of establishing a state and then embedding that state and becoming a self-functioning, self-sustaining entity.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. Today we're hearing the story of one of the world's tiniest states, Nauru. In the period following independence, the Nauruans enjoyed enormous wealth.
Especially after independence in 1968, after control of the Nauruan Phosphate Company, then the money that flowed in was just enormous. And there was this enormous perception that although Nauru was a very small country, and that it was unusual for such a small country to gain independence, the perception was that with this massive resource, this massive income coming in from phosphate, if it was wisely invested and wisely used, then that would be a guarantee of future economic success.
And was that the case?
No. What happened was that in the first 20 years of independence, a lot of money was spent on basic development priorities, some of which are extremely appropriate, better housing, electricity supplies, water supplies, and so on. But a lot of money was invested in things which never actually turned out to work. For example, buildings in overseas countries like Nauru House in Melbourne, hotels in some countries, phosphate factories, curiously, in countries like India and the Philippines, most of which never really survived. They weren't good investments. The most problematic thing of all, perhaps, was the investment in Air Nauru. For many years, Nauru ran in the 1970s and 80s, an airline, Air Nauru. Air Nauru had, at its peak, about 5 planes. Those planes ran to various places in the Pacific, but almost always with no one on board, and therefore running at an extraordinary loss. But this was a symbol of success. This was a national identity. This was progress. This was modernity. But economically, it was a disaster.
Well, this is the tragedy for Nauru, that once they finally got what was left, it was always a bit of a statistical aberration whether they were the world's richest people per capita or second richest. They were enormously wealthy, and in a kind of bizarre medical experiment, we now know what happens when you feed a group of people junk food for 20 years. They ended up with enormous diabetes problems, obesity problems, alcohol problems, even suicide problems, as a consequence of having all this money. But essentially, the government of Nauru, or successive governments of Nauru, managed to fritter away and lose their money through bad investments, sometimes straight-out robbery. Sometimes it was a good idea that didn't quite work out. And one of the more colourful ones was that they funded a London West End musical on the life of Leonardo da Vinci that bombed out almost within days of opening. But there was also the business there that they created a tax haven, and it turned out that a large percentage of Russia's GDP, as it came out of the Soviet era, ended up being registered into post boxes on Nauru. So they had a very bad experience themselves of being wealthy. That said, I don't think it necessarily excuses the colonial powers that had created the system where the money simply disappeared or was taken and exploited by a vast array of foreigners. And sometimes you'd go to Nauru and the plane would be full of carpetbaggers with various dreams and schemes to use Nauru's money.
In 1989, Nauru took legal action against Australia in the International Court of Justice for compensation for the environmental damage caused by phosphate mining. 4 years later, the case was settled out of court.
Australia wants Britain and New Zealand to help pay the bill for compensation for the Pacific Island nation of Nauru. During a visit to the island today, the Prime Minister Paul Keating agreed to a $107 million compensation payout to cover damages caused by years of phosphate mining on the island.
The compact of settlement essentially involves a settlement of $107 million, the bulk of it paid by the end of August 1994, so in the next 12 months, and then there is a stream of payments which run over the next 20 years.
In 1988, the Wiramantri Commission of Inquiry produced a 10-volume report. I had to apply to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here in New Zealand to go and read it. They had the only copy in New Zealand, and I had to read it accompanied by a foreign affairs official. And then Nauru filed there. It was $120 million Australian dollars suit against Australia. New Zealand wasn't actually mentioned in the thing, but clearly there was the implication that if they won that, then they would take on Britain and New Zealand. I was in Nauru, I think it was 1988 or 1989, when Australian Prime Minister Paul Keating was there along with the New Zealand Foreign Minister Don McKinnon to basically attend the Pacific Forum, but they also tried to settle things. And Australia went for a $107 million Australian settlement of the thing with Nauru. There was the usual weasel words about what happened, and it was a sort of on the basis of we will help Nauru, etc., but there's no recognition that we did wrong. But I would argue, as a student of Nauru history, that it was the grossest form of colonial exploitation that was seen in the Pacific.
John Connell says that as the 20th century drew to a close, the Nauruans could see that the phosphate was running out.
The phosphate was due to run out, everybody knew, around 2000. You could tell from the rate of progress that that's about when it would run out, and that's about when it did run out. So that what happened in those years was that for the first time, effectively for 20 years, Nauru had to start thinking about alternative sources of income. because clearly the phosphate was running out. So what they did is move into some rather strange areas. They became a tax haven. They started issuing passports to people willing to pay for them. And that lasted for a few years until the early 2000s, when pressure was placed on Nauru to close down those things after a couple of Al-Qaeda representatives had been found to be holding Nauru passports somewhere in Asia. And there was also a degree of illegal money laundering from the Russian mafia. So there was enormous pressure on Nauru to cut off that particular source of income.
By the new millennium, Nauru had been reduced to an environmental wasteland, and declining phosphate prices and the government's financial mismanagement had combined to virtually bankrupt the island. Life for its 10,000 inhabitants was pretty grim.
In the glory days, their life was a quite sort of perverse thing where they had an enormous shipping line. I can remember travelling on one of their passenger lines. They had an airline that went everywhere but had no passengers. Money just frittered away. But what you get now, I think, is a terribly sad reflection of the old adage that money can't buy you happiness. The Nauruans are essentially a sick people, physically a sick people. They have astonishing rates of diabetes and heart conditions and obesity. And they don't have a lot of money any longer. They seem to have lost, although it could be recovered, many of the traditional skills that they had. The waters around Nauru are rich in fish, and they could easily lead a healthy lifestyle. Their land, before it was destroyed, was very rich. The early accounts of explorers making first contact with Nauru are of a content people, well-fed. His argument, and it's debated, about the scale and intensity of warfare between the various groups. None of this is present now, and I don't mean it in an insulting fashion, but what you see is a population of battered survivors who have gone through hell and are trying to maintain what living standard they have, in this particular case, by taking money from Australia to hold asylum seekers.
Like a good Samaritan on the high seas, the captain of the Tampa rescued 430 mostly Afghanis from their sinking boat between Australian and Indonesian territorial waters, sparking an international incident. The decision to send Australian troops to board the ship and turn it away won the federal government both acclaim and condemnation. The resolution to the crisis became known as the Pacific Solution, with the federal government establishing detention centres in Papua New Guinea and on the tiny island nation of Nauru.
The Nauru Detention Centre opened in 2001 as a temporary measure to take refugees from the Tampa, but it became a permanent part of the Howard government's Pacific Solution. Asylum seekers taken there were to be processed under Australian law, and during the Howard years, the vast majority of them were determined to be refugees and were settled in Australia. The centre was closed by Kevin Rudd after his election in 2007, but reopened again by Julia Gillard in 2012. In the lead-up to last year's election, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd introduced a change to the end point in the process, meaning that those who are determined to be refugees would not be settled in Australia, a policy continued by the Abbott government. Although living conditions have been condemned by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Nauru's regional processing centre has provided a boost to the economy.
At the moment, Nauru's economy is doing very well in the sense that the presence of the regional processing centre on Nauru has created a huge economic injection, both in terms of an injection into public revenue and an injection into the more local economy. It's created jobs. People can rent their houses to those working at the centre. There is some demand for local goods and services going into the centre. So the economy is functioning at one level. In terms of a sustainable economy, Nauru is very vulnerable. If and when the RPC closes, it's hard to know what Nauru's next economic sustenance will be. There is a certain amount of money to be made in issuing of fishing licences, which Nauru does. There is still some money to be made in phosphate. There are some tailings and there are possible opportunities for further mining. But life is tough for a lot of people. There are very few employment opportunities. The private sector is very, very small, to the point of being not much more than a few trade stores. You know, if you're trying to build a house on Nauru, it's very hard to get access to a builder or an electrician or a plumber. Those sorts of trades do not exist because there is no real market for them. So other than the public service and the RPC, at the moment there are very few opportunities in terms of employment in Nauru. And obviously that then creates a bit of a vicious cycle because there are so few opportunities, there are very few incentives to get qualifications and be able to enter into employment because, you know, there's no point getting a qualification if there isn't going to be a job for you at the end. And so what we see is in key sectors in Nauru where there is really limited capacity, and the legal sector is one that really illustrates this, is that the capacity has been and looks like it will continue to be supplemented and supported by expatriate professionals who work in line in Nauru governments, which is not common in the Pacific. But in Nauru, we have seen that expatriates, Australian and New Zealand predominantly, but from other countries as well, working in inline positions, basically to keep the institutions of the state running because there is no one else to take on those roles.
It's not unusual in the Pacific for the judiciary to be made up at least partly by people from Australia and New Zealand because of limited resources and their lack of qualified lawyers with a sufficient status in the legal profession to be regarded as credible judicial officers.
I spoke to Kevin Borum from the ANU School of Law about the recent expulsion by the Nauru government of resident magistrate Peter Law and the cancellation of the visa of its Chief Justice Geoffrey Eames, both Australian citizens.
Nauru only has 10,000 people. The judicial system is also substantially dependent on development assistance financing from Australia and New Zealand. So not only the judicial officers largely Australian, but also the entire judicial system is underpinned by funding from Australia and New Zealand.
Can you explain why these two Australian legal figures were expelled?
The Nauru government, of course, has only provided broad justifications along the lines that Nauru has its own sovereignty and is intended to protect that sovereignty against interference by outsiders. And they have suggested that the former resident magistrate was acting contrary to the interests of Nauru. Now, of course, that should be irrelevant in the case of a judicial officer who is supposed to simply follow the law. But that is what Nauru has said. And they appear to have been concerned that the Australian Chief Justice might back up the resident magistrate whom Nauru has expelled. The origin of this whole dispute seems to have been with the Nauru government's desire to expel an Australian called Rod Henshaw, who had previously had a position with the Nauru government. As I understand it, the resident magistrate had brought down an order halting that deportation, and that was what led to the resident magistrate's expulsion. And as I say, there seemed to have been a concern that the Australian Chief Justice would support the resident magistrate's action. So arising from this initial episode with Rod Henshaw, there seems to have been a desire by the Nauru government to exercise control over the courts so the courts would not act contrary to what Nauru's government saw as being its own business.
Clearly what you've seen in Nauru in this particular case is the almost xenophobic nature of Nauruan society to foreigners. I heard one particular interview with the Nauru Chief Justice who sort of said, well, the Nauru government didn't like some of our decisions, so they kicked us out. And then he went on to say, but that's what judges of our level do. We challenge the government. In Nauru, that kind of attacking the very nature of being Nauruan, in a sense. And we have to recognise, both in Nauru and in Banaba, that the Western court system has done them no justice at all. For example, in the case of the Banabans, whose fate can be tied in with the Nauruans, they took what proved to be the longest ever legal case in British legal history and lost when they tried to sue the British government over their loss of their land and their phosphate royalties. And oddly enough, the judges in that particular case said that the Barnabins were right. They were morally right, but legally wrong. So they lost everything. So if I was in Nauruan, I'd be a little sceptical too of Western justice. If I was looking to move forward, I wouldn't be looking at Australia or New Zealand. I would be looking at a similar country like Samoa or something to see if you can blend culture and jurisprudence into a more indigenous kind of justice system. And that's what you see in Nauru. And I don't think you can underestimate the sheer scale of the impact that Australia is having on this small country. I can't conceive of a town in New Zealand of 10,000 people which would remain the same, would remain unchanged by the input of a vast number of asylum seekers in the security situation and the financial situation that we're talking about. It sounds tragic to say it, but Australia is doing the damage. It's not Nauruans doing the damage, in my view.
So what lies ahead for Nauru?
Well, it's hard to predict, and after nearly 20 years in the Pacific, I've become increasingly cautious about predicting what's going to happen next. It's a very serious situation. I spoke extensively with David Lamborn, who's the former Secretary of Justice in Nauru, and he described it as a coup by stealth. So basically, the rule of law, as we would normally understand it, does not apply at the moment in Nauru. So whoever you are on Nauru, whether you are an asylum seeker, whether you are an Australian resident working for the RPC, or more importantly, a citizen of Nauru, there is no guarantee that any of your legal rights and interests can be adequately protected within that jurisdiction. The Chief Justice, Geoffrey Eames, has had his visa withdrawn, which basically means he is not able to travel to the country in order to convene his court. So if you have an order made against you or a decision made by the government that you wish to challenge, that you would normally challenge in the Supreme Court, it is now extremely difficult for you to follow that path, because whilst Chief Justice Eames can convene his court outside of the jurisdiction, so he doesn't have to be physically present, obviously there is no legal enforcement remedy available to him. So he can sit in Melbourne and issue as many orders as he likes, but he knows, and we know, that they're not going to be executed within the jurisdiction. And we've seen numerous instances of the government effectively just making cabinet decisions and officials executing those decisions without any reference to whether or not they have any lawful basis, without any reference to whether or not they could be challenged in court. And basically people have realised really quickly that there is absolutely no point in seeking to challenge those decisions because you're not going to get anywhere.
That's Tess Newton-Cain from the research consultancy Dev Pacific. On Rear Vision today, you also heard Professor John Connell from the School of Geosciences at the University of Sydney, Kevin Borum from the ANU School of Law, and veteran South Pacific reporter Michael Field from Fairfax Media. There'll be a transcript of this program on the Rear Vision website, where you can also listen to the program again or download it. And don't forget, you can sign up for a regular podcast of Rear Vision at abc.net.au/radionational. Judy Rapley is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips. Thanks for listening.
On By Design, now available online, we visit perhaps one of Australia's most controversial building sites.
It's going to be very sculptural. Three petals twisting and rising up and filling the space in between. So there's a twist. Would have been very difficult to build in the past a building with a twist. This has a 60-degree twist.
That's By Design, whenever you like it, at abc.net.au/rn.